Good evening. My name is Paul Holden Graybund. I'm the director of Live from the New York Public Library, and it's a great, great pleasure to welcome you tonight. I'm sorry you had to go up and down and sideways and digress to finally arrive here, but we have many things going on at the library tonight. I wish I had more power and I just could have made things happen in a different room, but here you are, and I'm very glad that you made it here tonight to hear this conversation that I will be having with Atul Gawande. Before I get to the evening per se, let me just remind you that we have other programs coming up. In fact, we have about 5 or 6 programs happening in the next 3 or 4 days, it would seem. Tomorrow, I will have the pleasure of interviewing our president, the president of the New York Public Library, Paul Leclerc. He will be in conversation with Bruno Racine, the president of the Bibliothèque Nationale de France. We will be talking about the future of libraries and reading in the digital age. Whenever I hear the word of future of anything, I think of Paul Valéry's famous comment that the future isn't what it used to be. So we'll see how that all goes. With the Penn World Voices Festival, we are hosting 3 events. I'll be interviewing Harold Bloom. We will also have the pleasure of having Jonathan Galassi speak about Leopardi. And Voyl Soyinka will be giving the Arthur Miller Lecture for Freedom. So do come to that. The title of his talk is Humpty Dumpty Still on the Wall. Later next week, Elizabeth Gilbert will be here. Ralph Nader will be speaking with Peter Lewis and Ted Turner about what billionaires can do and why they might be able to help us if they give back their money. And we will also be having Chris Blackwell later in about a couple of weeks. Chris Blackwell, for those of you who are not familiar with his name, is the founder of Island Records, and he will be speaking about the 50 years of Island Records, so do come for that. Atul Gawande is the author of Better, Complications, and the Checklist Manifesto, a MacArthur Fellow, a general endocrine surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, a staff writer for The New Yorker, and an associate professor at Harvard Medical School and the Harvard School of Public Health. He also leads the World Health Organization's Safe Surgery Saves Lives program. Before bringing Atul Gawande on stage, I will ask Flash Rosenberg, our live artist in residence, to introduce a piece she drew on the occasion of a live event we did about obituaries. I am quite fascinated by obituaries. This event was called, quite naturally, Live from the New York Public Library Presents Dead from the New York Public Library. Tonight in the audience we may have many doctors. That night we had quite a few obituary writers and journalists. The New York Times undertakers were all there en masse.
Thank you, Paul, for the opportunity to be artist in residence for Live. While listening to conversations such as we're about to hear tonight, I translate the ideas discussed into drawing. I'll be in the back at this lit-up workstation making a portrait of what it feels like to be all of us, to be in the audience, and you know, trying to understand how concepts look as they land on us and mingle in the room. While doodling, my sketches are videotaped and then edited to create the animated summary. These drawings are not caricatures, they're not court portraits. I'm sitting way too, far too back to be able to see clearly what the speakers look like, because what's more important to me is to show how the speakers think. The cameras are here to show how they look. Tonight's topic, as he just said, since it's being mortal and other tragedies, we're going to see a finished conversation portrait from this past program that seems perhaps related. And if you'd like to see more on other subjects, you can go to my website and see things from Dada to homework, from Silence to Jay-Z. Go to Vimeo, Vimeo.com/myname, Flash Rosenberg. Thank you.
Flash Rosenberg, thank you very much. When asked to submit a biography in 7 words, Atul Gawande wrote, surgeon, writer, public health researcher, professional dilettante. Welcome, Atul Gawande. Bruce Springsteen. You have any idea why we're playing that?
No.
Should I tell the audience?
Please do.
I think I read, I may be wrong, that under certain circumstances you listen to this music.
Yes, in the operating room, no less. This is on my playlist last week.
So while you're operating, you're listening to Bruce Springsteen?
Among others, yeah.
Does this help?
Yes, but in the sense that in an operating room, you have a group of people. You're going to be there for 12, 14 hours. And what you need to get through the day is a group of people and also get through your own part of the case. For me, music is an important tool for doing that. Number one, if I pick the music really well, then the nurses and anesthesiologists I want are likely to pick me for my room. And I get known a little bit for my playlists and get certain people I want coming in the door. And if I pick the music well,
I never thought of it this way.
Yes, no, it's very important, very important. And also, you know, you mix in certain things in case that there's certain people you don't want. You can switch over to, you know, putting some rap on or something you know they hate, and they'll take a break and not come back. So it's just another manipulation tool. But also for me, it's you do five cases in a day. It's a long day. It definitely keeps me going. It's great.
I have to say that you probably are the first person I've invited to a live program to whom I've written a fan letter. I wrote to you as you and invited you because I read this piece, which for those of you who haven't read it, I highly encourage you to read it, called Letting Go. It was in the New Yorker about 9 months ago, in August of last year. And I remember writing to you, and I said that I believe that piece should be, and I'm sorry if I'm making you blush, but should be read.
It's harder for people to tell.
And you're quite, actually, a little digression. You've written about blushing.
Yes. and an operation to remove the ability to blush.
It's interesting, the subjects you choose, blushing, itching, subjects which
the
might
cost
be...
cost of American healthcare.
The cost of American healthcare. We will get to that as well, I promise you. And I said in my note to you that you... The piece you wrote should be translated, in my view, in every language known to man, and should be read, and I don't know why I said this exactly, but I said to you it should be read 3 times in a lifetime. And I don't exactly know at what time that would be, whether it should be when you're 15, 55, and if you're so lucky, 75. But I felt that people should read it many times in their lifetime. And you wrote back to me very kindly saying that you hoped I knew some good translators, but really, really didn't have too much time. You were dealing with more important things and coming to talk at the New York healthcare reform and all kinds of other issues. And then you wrote to me about 2 months ago, which is a reason that this event came up quite spontaneously, saying, I'm in New York on the 28th of April. If you'd like, we can talk about death and dying that night. And here
and
we are.
Said yes.
And I said yes. I mean, I'm always ready to talk about death and dying. And I thought this was, you know, a cheery subject for our audience. And so we should go...
What better at the beginning of spring.
We should go ahead with it. Now, one of the things that I find most daunting and haunting about your piece is the way in which you articulate what I would call the notion that modern medicine, perhaps our modern times now, have robbed us of our own deaths. And the words may be strong, but I think in effect, in some form or fashion, this is what you say. Our what we do only once in our lifetime is taken away from us.
It's not too strong. We've taken what was traditionally an experience that was in our control, in our families' control, it was in our homes, it was governed by family, by community, and by religion, and we handed it over to medicine. And it's been this half-century experiment with what happens when you do that. And what we've done is handed over to lots of people like me who have certain tools at our disposal. Doctors have ICUs, and we have lots of medical technologies and a variety of things that help us meet certain purposes, like trying to see if we can make sure we can live as long as possible. But I think it's proving to have been a failure in major ways. We are not successful in meeting the range of needs that people have towards the end of life, needs that they voice in study after study and surveys that are not only that I want my best chance at living as long a life as possible, but also that when I face death, that I have some independence, I have some control as much as possible, that I get to be with family. Many people consider it important to have the touch of other human beings, that they be mentally aware. Some people want to be as mentally aware as possible. Other people don't want to be as mentally aware as possible. We never ask you, which one are you? And the signs are that over and over again, we fail people. And most people, death is miserable. But we have handed over to medicine, and we've failed helping people meet their concerns at the end of life.
You said death is miserable. In some way, it's unbearable.
The hardest... So, I wrote the article not because I knew anything about what I thought about it. What I knew was a lot of the surgery I do is for cancer patients. And what I knew was over and over again, it felt like I was not very successful for them beyond, you know, what I could do surgically. And it was these incredibly fraught discussions. You know, do I tell them? How much do I push about what their prognosis is and things like that? And when I started, so the article takes a 34-year-old patient of mine whom we diagnosed with a advanced lung cancer during the 8th month of her pregnancy. And it was incurable. The average life expectancy is about a year when that happens. And we walked her through 4 different rounds of chemotherapy and radiation and just, you know, misery after misery. At the same time, she was incredibly optimistic, a fighter, wanted to move ahead, but I felt we'd failed her. And when I started talking through it with some other people like palliative care specialists who see hundreds of people, they, one in particular, Susan Block, said that to me that what you have to understand is people are negotiating an enormous anxiety about what's to come. And when you say unbearable, that's exactly it. It is being able to help people through the tremendous anxiety of everything they're facing and all they're burdened with. And when you've handed over this whole experience to medicine, and all we want to deal with is one corner of that anxiety, can I live a little longer? It's no surprise that the families who have taken family members through this experience just find it's been utterly miserable and not peaceful until... we've developed some options, other ways of trying to deal with it.
And I mean the word, I think you understood it that way, I mean the word unbearable quite literally.
Yeah.
In rereading your great essay, I came across a piece that David Reif, the son of Susan Sontag, wrote in The Guardian after writing a memoir about his mother. And he says, but no amount of familiarity could lessen the degree to which the idea of death was unbearable to her. In her eyes, mortality seemed as unjust as murder. Subjectively, there was simply no way she could ever accept it.
When I have to break the news of a incurable cancer, or actually the more difficult time is when someone has come to the emergency room with a crisis from a terminal illness that they had successfully fought through previous crises before. They'd been through the first round of chemotherapy for that advanced cancer, or they had the congestive heart failure and had had three pneumonias that they had gotten through before, but this time they've got a new problem, and it's not clear that this time is going to be the time they're going to make their way through it. Those are the moments when you sit down and you try to figure out how you even have a conversation about this, and it's always incredibly pressured, and you realize they hadn't contemplated this moment at all. They hadn't prepared for it. They hadn't thought about it. They're often at this point, you know, they're short of breath. They're delirious. They're getting pain medication, and so unable to think much further. And still, you you have different reactions, but a fair number of people for whom they cannot imagine that this might be the week, that they're, or the day. They're not ready for it. It's not bearable. They don't want to have that discussion. It's not possible. And in the throes of crisis, it often isn't simply possible. It's not just impossible for them. It's impossible sometimes for the family members. And so, you know, often the reaction among medical people is, well, the problem is Americans. You know, Americans are in denial of mortality. We think we can live forever. With my work with the World Health Organization, I've been lucky and gotten to go to many places around the world. And it turns out when you go to lots of places around the world, they expect to live forever too. They don't want to die. It doesn't turn out to be all that different.
What is it about us humans that we want to continue forever?
Maybe that we're human. I mean, you know, you can't imagine the extinguishing of yourself. It's awful to contemplate. At the same time, there is the only way we are good at being able to deal with what life is going to throw at us is partly by being willing to be prepared for it and imagine it and discuss and think about it a little bit. And the people who have amazingly different experiences, and that's what I learned out of...
And that's what you write about to some extent. Is
paying attention to what the experiences are of people who do differently. So there's this really, I think, fundamentally important study from 7 cancer centers around the United States where they looked at the care of people with stage 4 cancers, advanced cancers, not curable. On average, when they were interviewing the patients and their families, they were 4 months or less from death. And only 1/3 had any discussion with their clinicians about their goals or wishes for the end of life. And that third, however, where the clinician had even the slightest conversation, enough that they discussed a little bit about, you know, suppose the treatment doesn't work, what's important to you, or is there anything you want to think about? That third were less likely to die in the hospital, less likely to die in intensive care, less likely to have, you know, CPR when their heart finally stopped, less likely to have suffered. They then surveyed the families about the experience, and those patients had less suffering, more likely to have chosen hospice for the final stage. And the really interesting part was that 6 months later, their caregivers were 3 times less likely to have major depression. They were less likely to have suffered as well. Now, we think that choice of talking about what might come with death or choosing hospice or things like that means that they're giving up on life. But there have been a number of studies, and most recently last summer from the Mass General Hospital, that show it's almost the opposite. They did a study with advanced lung cancer patients where they randomly sent half to see a palliative care specialist to talk about what if the treatment doesn't work. And these are all patients in whom it's not going to work. And still saw their oncologist. And the others just saw their oncologist and went through care in the usual way. The group that got the palliative care discussions had the same experience. Less like that in the hospital, less suffering, less intensive care, more likely to not take that third or fourth round of chemotherapy. And the really fascinating thing in that study was they lived 25% longer. If having these discussions were a drug, the FDA would approve it as life-saving.
But it would seem that quite au contraire, these conversations don't happen. And they don't happen for a number of reasons. And they are actually very hard. I mean, one of the things that I find the most powerful in letting go is that you admit at several times during the essay that you also are wanting to speak to the patient, but instead you are, as Reef talks about his mother, morally cheerleading them also.
Yeah. Sarah Monopoly comes to my office with her baby in the carriage coming along each time.
Less well.
But she was coming to see me not for her lung cancer. She had her thoracic surgeon. She had her oncologist. She was seeing me because in the workup of her lung cancer, it was found she had a second cancer, a cancer of her thyroid, which was a curable cancer. And she was seeing me because this cancer had spread throughout her neck and was operable. And the discussion was, so are we going to operate? And the thyroid cancer would have taken 5 or 10 years to kill her. Whereas the lung cancer, the thyroid cancer was never going to be something that was going to hurt her life. She had no symptoms from it. She had no pain from it. And so when I met her, the discussion should have been, with the reality of the lung cancer, I wouldn't recommend the operation, that you wouldn't need it. But in order for me to come to the right decision, which is not to put her through what would have been a big operation, given the spread of the thyroid cancer in her neck, in order to arrive at that, I had to confront her lung cancer and have a discussion about what the reality of that was. And I was not comfortable having that. She's tremendously upbeat. She's charming, and she's got her makeup and put on her dress perfectly for the appointment. She's eternally optimistic. Every time she comes in, you know, it's we can do this. Her husband's business, and he's, you know, what do we do next? What's the next plan here? And the babies, you know, they're rocking the baby, and I'm going to say, you're not going to live long enough for this cancer to make a difference. It was far easier for me to chicken out of that conversation, and I did. I tried to find a way in between. I said, well, I don't want to halt the chemotherapy for your lung cancer right now for your thyroid cancer, so why don't I have you come back in 6 weeks? We'll see how your chemotherapy is doing. And then we'll make a plan for operating on you in 2 months. You know, I'll see you, we'll make the plans, it'll be great. And I basically stalled like that, appointment after appointment, until it was obvious that we were nearing the end. And we just kept rescheduling her operation for a little while later. Oh, you know, you're not breathing so well at this time. Maybe we should think about put it off for another couple of months. And what we all did in our silos, the oncology specialist, the thoracic surgeon, we all dealt with our own little corner of the issue, found it hard to push up against her optimism, even though we all did say to her, we know the lung cancer is incurable. So we're just going, you know, this is a statement you'll hear a lot from doctors. It's a kind of mantra we say. Your disease isn't curable, but it is treatable. And then we talk about, you know, the ways in which we might be able to get a little more time with this and a little more time with that. And so we do that dance without quite coming to the discussion of, okay, what happens? How do we prepare for the moment when it might, when it won't work?
In your book, Better, you have this line, in a way, our task is to always fight, but our fight is not always to do more. It is to do right by our patients, even though what is right is not always clear. And this is what you're describing here, or grappling with.
Yeah, in the essay, I tried to think about that metaphor of fighting again, and I used the metaphor of the general.
Yeah.
That you want to fight, but what do you do in the face of an enemy with superior forces? An enemy who is going to win. There's Custer, who fought to the point of total annihilation. And he's held up as an example of a general who was a failed general because he had done more damage to his troops by doing that than would have been incurred otherwise. And you contrast that with General Lee in Civil War, who knew when there was time to fight for whatever territory you could get, and then knew when there was time that you needed to let go. Sometimes even with, you know, other people saying, that's a mistake, it's the wrong move, but he spared his...
So sometimes you don't send your soldiers into battle.
Yes.
And in this particular case, in the medical field, it would mean what?
What it would mean is being able to talk through the concept of letting go. And the best way to understand it, I think, is understanding it doesn't mean doing nothing. I didn't really understand that until I went walking around with a hospice nurse who did her job day to day. And she was incredible. I sent the occasional person to... In fact, in the article, I wrote about her, and her name was Sarah Creed, and I didn't give her age because I didn't think anybody would believe it. She was 27.
She doesn't appear that way at all.
No, she was incredibly wise. You would go with her to the door of a patient who she'd been caring for a firefighter who had a pancreatic cancer, had gone through three different rounds of treatment, just this horrendous course, clearly pulled and extended beyond anywhere they should have gotten. He was in terrible pain, difficulty breathing, hadn't received adequate pain medication in weeks.
Married to another firefighter.
Married to another firefighter who was... fighters.
I mean, real fighters. Yeah.
And they get home when all the treatments, everyone at the hospital finally said, well, we don't have anything more. And went home to die and thought might be a couple of days. And she walks into the situation and her immediate response is, there's almost nothing. I should have been here a week ago. I could have helped you. But let me take this from what we've got and just move forward. And one of the things was the firefighter was afraid of taking the pain medication. He said, it feels like defeat. And she got down on her knees in front of him and said, you've got a beautiful wife, a beautiful daughter who is, as we're having this conversation, walking in and out of the room. She's 4 years old and depositing little stuffed animals in his lap, one by one, with a little menagerie accumulating. She said, in pain, you cannot be with them. You can't be who you want to be. Press the button. And he pressed the button. Became willing to at least take the pain medication to get through it. And he lived another week after that, improved enough that he actually got out of the house and they were able to go to a favorite restaurant that he and his wife always had. He couldn't eat. He didn't want to eat anything, but he was just absorbing what it was like to be there. And that was his first moment out of a hospital bed, not in a hospital, not in, in months. And what's really striking about that concept, it's not only her wisdom and what she could manage to do, but the tools that she brought were different from the tools that I bring as a doctor. The tools that she brought were ones for, in medicine what we do is we say, how much suffering we're going to put you through some suffering right now for the sake of time later. You know, let's gamble on the time you're going to get later. And they walk in the door and they say, what do we need to do to make you happy today?
Now.
Today is the day.
The present time.
And, you know, whatever life has dealt us, what do we want to live for today?
So to go back to those two generals, one who gives up is, in fact, choosing a quality of life for his troops, which is much better.
He's saying, what is the best we can do today?
Today. And what the best we can do today, your article proposes, is perhaps in certain situations choose hospice.
Yeah, the striking thing about hospice to me was I thought of them as the black hooded people who came around with morphine injections. And we walked in to see Lee Cox, who was this 72-year-old woman with a congestive heart failure who'd had multiple hospital admissions for getting more and more short of breath. She was on oxygen at home. She was sent home with a few weeks to live. And I as Sarah Creed came to see her, she has a 20-foot-long oxygen tubing tether to her nose and comes up to the door. And she's getting some chest pain that day, and she's having some particular difficulties. And Sarah does some, you know, instead of saying, well, let's just give you some morphine for that pain, she does some detective work and figures out that her medications hadn't been filled and she had run out of her heart pills and that her nebulizer machine wasn't working properly, and arranges for someone to fix the nebulizer machine and get the heart pills. And I said to her when we left, I said, that was confusing to me. I thought the goal of hospice was just to let nature take its course. Why were you trying to fix her breathing and fix her her heart medications and all that kind of thing? And she said, no, the goal is help her live the best possible day she can have today. And day by day, they did that to the point she lived a year on hospice. The average congestive heart failure patient on hospice lives 3 months longer than the congestive heart failure patients in the same condition without hospice. And it's really striking. It's almost zen. By not asking that you live longer, you might live longer.
One of the aspects of your article that I find also tremendously haunting is that you repeat several times that we don't know what dying is really, and we don't understand it, and we don't know in our modern world today what dying means.
Yeah,
which I think is
science has changed it and changed it so fundamentally it's harder to understand what the term means. But and I mean it by this: for most of history, sickness came on unpredictably, and what happened tended to happen, in most cases, leave tuberculosis aside and a couple of other conditions, but for most people,
it came quickly.
And you know, George Washington got a strep throat and died 24 hours later.
I was just about to say, you go through various presidents to tell us how quickly they died.
Exactly. You know.
Yeah, it was a very ingenious of you to choose a president. Some of them died slower, but many of them died very quickly.
Yes, and from things that you would now be able to turn into a nicely long, drawn-out course. And so if you have a terminal cancer now, where before it wouldn't get picked up until its late stage, and then you'd usually pass in a matter of days to weeks, now we pick it up early, start treating it in certain ways. And so are you dying? Or when are you dying? If you have a terminal cancer where the average survival is 3 years, so when did you start dying and when did you not start dying? Or, you know, I tell the story of a patient I had who, you know, was a woman who had a horrendous range of problems. She had a ruptured intestine from an infection that started the whole thing. In the operation, we were able to take care of that problem and stop it. But she was so sick, she had a heart attack in the course of events, and then her blood pressure was so low that she ended up losing circulation to her leg and got gangrene of her leg, and then she was in respiratory failure. And so we got her through, you know, after a couple of weeks in the intensive care unit, it became clear I was going to need to amputate her leg and give her a tracheostomy and a feeding tube, and that her abdomen was wide open and it would take weeks of IV nutrition. And so I met with her family, her sisters, to ask, should we go through with amputation and a breathing tube and tracheotomy? And they asked, is she dying? I can tell you we could have kept her going for months. So I didn't even know how you answer that question anymore. It depends. And so our language is not evolved. There are many things that have not evolved to keep up with what the experience of an advanced illness is like now. Our language, our traditions. There was a whole set of rituals around what happens. There was a deathbed ritual.
The Ars Moriendi, you speak about that briefly.
Yeah, the Ars Moriendi, as I mispronounce it.
My Latin pronunciation may not be perfect. Who am I to talk about pronunciation anyway? You know, but if you want to say Ars Moriendi, please do.
Okay. So, is the title of a book that came out in 1451. Went through dozens of languages and editions, and was incredibly popular. And it was a guidebook for the art of dying. And the art of dying included how certain rituals to bring that you, for a family member, that you make sure that they have their last confession, that they work at acknowledging their sins, that they give up their worldly possessions, that they embrace God, that the family is at the bedside, that there are last words, and you want to have the wisdom of the last words.
I think that's so interesting. In the article, you come back to that two or three times about people who are robbed of their last words. We don't anymore have this tradition, it would seem, of the wisdom of transmitting last words. I mean, there's a whole literature about that, and sometimes a very funny one, as in, you know, Oscar Wilde, who said, either the wallpaper goes or I go. You know, I mean, so we
and a lot of it embellished.
Yeah, of course.
Well, exactly. You know that, and it's a strange thing. We have more time, so you might think
we
would
have too much time.
We might have that you think we might have developed even more around it, but instead, because we are in denial of the possibility that this might be the moment, we don't want to even record the ideas. That's problem number one. Problem number two is we've tubed and drugged people to the point of oblivion so that they're incoherent for days and weeks sometimes before the end. And we've turned it into a hospital experience where the attendants are the nurse and maybe the doctor. You're not quite sure. You know, how many times is it that I've had a patient pass away and it's all about calling the family up at home and telling them, you know, yes, last night they did pass away, and they've missed it all. And the most, you know, imagine yourself, you go to the intensive care unit and you see the families together, and what you have to imagine is that this person came into the hospital not knowing that this was the end, not prepared to say, I love you, or I'm sorry, or any of those things. All those unsaid things that you want to say before you go, and the husband is sitting with the wife who's now tubed and completely out and now not coming back, and only slowly dawning, and then it's gone. It's all happened, and it's happened so traumatically that it's not surprising that people are three times more likely to be severely depressed 6 months later. Joan Didion's Year of Magical Thinking was in part the reflection of someone who'd gone through tremendous grief, because in her case, her husband died just sitting right at the table with a massive heart attack and suddenly was gone and taken away. That's another way that in former times you could suddenly go. It's much less likely today, but in a certain way, people grieved then more violently as well, for the similar reason. You didn't have that chance for connection.
There's well-known French historian named Philippe Ariès, who wrote a big, massive book on man confronting death. And he wrote a series of lectures also called Western Attitudes Towards Death, in which he says, thus, that is, calmly, did people die in the course of centuries or millennia. This ancient attitude for which death was familiar, close and softened, indifferent in one, contrasts abruptly to our own, in which death arouses fear in us to the point that we no longer dare to call it by its name. This is why I call that familiar death tame death. I do not mean by that that it had earlier been wild. I mean, on the contrary, that it has become wild today.
I have to say, I react to that partly by being a little contrarian about it. I mean, I don't want to idealize death in the past. It was sometimes violent, sometimes horrendous, sometimes, you know, it's the full variety of experience. Part of the point to me is that we've changed death. We've made it a long, drawn-out experience. We've made the nursing home your most common, well, made the hospital your most common likely last address. And if not that, then the nursing home. And we've turned, the most likely way we go now is by having an illness that we can at the beginning treat and then can't. And that it takes a long time. It's a long process. And that is life then. This is part of our experience. It is a significant part of our experience, both as family members going through this with parents, siblings, even sometimes our children. And we have not embraced the concept that there is life to be lived in that time. There are things that are worth doing and worth going for. It's interesting to me, you know, you have these movies like The Bucket List, which have this idea like, yes, the doc has told me I have 9 months to live, and so, you know, let's get these 18 things done. And the truth of the matter is we never want to give you that prognosis because we're afraid we're going to be wrong, and then you're going to say, he said I'm going to live 6 months, and I live 12 months. And, you know, that partly not wanting to be wrong, especially in the wrong direction kind of thing. And then the fact that treatment itself weakens you, the disease weakens you. It is a wild course, but devoid of all those things that are meaningful. And I think part of the experience of seeing what people who've chosen hospice, which is only a minority of Americans.
What is the percentage?
It's between 25 and 30% who choose hospice, and most only in the very last few days, when it can't do very much. I think the average is around 4 days before death. Whereas the folks who have chosen it at the later stages, when it can still be helpful, are people who've started to turn the question not towards, not towards the idea that there isn't the you may not have given up on the possibility that something might happen, but at least have said to themselves, well, there's a very likely thing that's about to happen, and I at least want to live as well as I can in the face of it, at minimum with less pain and less suffering, and ideally with just some more control over the circumstances in my own home with the people I want to be with, not riding ambulances back and forth. I wrote an article about McAllen, Texas, the most expensive county for healthcare in the country. And for a 65-year-old or older there, the average cost is $16,000 per person per year compared to $8,000 per person per year. And one of the things that are very expensive there is end-of-life costs. And I came to recognize what one of my colleagues has created is a ambulance-to-hospice ratio. So in Portland, Oregon, the ambulance to hospice ratio is about 1-to-1. That is, in the last year of life, it's about $500 on average in ambulance rides and $500 in hospice costs. And in McAllen, Texas, it's $3,000 in ambulance rides and only $22 in hospice costs. And you can imagine the picture of it, that you're spending that time riding ambulances back and forth between the hospital, as opposed to how much of that resource is spent on being at home.
That precious time. I was rereading a book by Walter Kaufmann, a philosopher who wrote a book called The Face of a Heretic. And he says, as one deserves a good night's sleep, one also deserves to die. Why should I hope to wake again? To do what I have not done in time I've had. All of us have so much more time than we use well. And I wonder how you react to something like that. I mean, Seneca said something not dissimilar.
Yeah, the problem is I still want to live forever.
Yeah.
But the finiteness of time is the theme of all of our lives. It's all governed around the idea, then, how do you make the most of what you have? And we all try to remind ourselves about that and try to remember it when we're instead spending all our time blackberrying, which I seem to do. The ability to remind yourself, so I don't want to spend all my life thinking about the fact that I'm going to die, and you want to simply live life and take it as it comes. And when it comes to what that moment of reality that you're going to face death is about, I think it's less about the idea that, yes, I'm going to die. I think it intellectually and even in our bones, we know that's going to happen. And with the patients...
But it's a funny knowledge, right? It's a knowledge that doesn't acknowledge itself completely as knowledge.
What do you mean by that?
I think we, you know, when a French philosopher, when Sartre said that it's always the other who dies, I think he was right. In some way, we always think it's other people who die and not us.
This gets at this idea that I wrote about in the piece, that none of us have any practice at it.
Right. We do it, you say it quite clearly, and quite pungently. You say we die once.
You only die once, and therefore it's not an experience we recognize or can quite imagine for ourselves, and doesn't seem relevant to us. Seems plenty relevant to other people, but, you know, what's the reason that I might not be different from anybody else? You know, maybe I'm different. It's possible. Can't scientifically prove I'm not different. But
nevertheless nevertheless, you and I are going to die. My mother always told me when I was growing up that living is dangerous and the outcome is always fatal. And so, you know, and there is that aspect to it. But somehow we push it aside. We really push it aside.
And maybe we do in order to get through the day. But I think that...
But at the same time, yes, we do it to get through the day. We do it in order to blackberry, and I have the same problem you do. My children no longer think that a blackberry is a fruit. I mean, it's the same kind of issue and problem, one might say. Nevertheless, to some extent, I think what you're also trying to urge us to think about is to think about death, and to, in some way, you're not far removed from Cicero's great comment that to philosophize is to learn how to die. In some way, we need to think about it.
So earlier on, you were talking about the idea that, you know, there's a moment when you might want to read the essay, and I think there are that gets at an idea that I think it's impossible to prepare for the long run. It's part of the reason why living wills are so ineffectual. They are, a legal tool to, and it's helpful for you to fill out a living will that express your wishes for when the time may come, you know, whether you'd want to be sustained with heroic means or not. But it is so removed from the moment when you have to think about crises that it usually is very difficult to apply. You know, when a family member brings in the living will, it usually isn't able to help us in that moment because we don't know what is in that person's head closer to the time when crisis comes. And so my best way of thinking about it is that there are moments when this conversation and these thoughts become very relevant. It's not at a random moment. It's not trying to think about it constantly through your life. I don't know how I would get through my life trying to think about it. But when you have been, on some simple level, yes, the conversation that I have with my wife, you know, my wife is like, "Do not unplug me," and if my brain is not working, you better unplug me. But beyond that, there will come a moment where I'll have some sort of illness that is not going to be curable, and I'll feel fine. We'll go through an initial treatment, and it'll buy me some time. But if I just wait till the crisis comes and I'm in an ambulance, unable to breathe, and we're headed to the emergency room, and the question is, do I want to be on a ventilator or not? Because suppose I could get through it this time. It's pneumonia. Maybe I will. Maybe I won't. The moments when you want to have that discussion are in the kind of before that happens. It's too late if it's the ambulance ride. And it's too early if it's 20 years beforehand to really imagine it. And so there are almost trigger points. It's when you need oxygen at home and you have a congestive heart failure. It's when that first round of chemotherapy didn't work. And yes, we're going to consider a second round and maybe a third round and maybe radiation, but now's the moment when the signs are that this may not, we're potentially not winning here. With a Alzheimer's patient, it's when the early memory loss starts to appear, but before you've lost contact with the world. And that's when you ask certain questions that we don't ask.
What would those questions be?
There were four that Susan Block, who I mentioned earlier, the palliative care doctor, told me were the ones that people need, but they don't get. Number one is, do you know what your prognosis is? What do you understand about your prognosis? Number two was, if you should get sicker, what are your biggest fears and concerns? Number three was, what was number three? Oh, yes, number three was, if you continue to get sicker, what are your goals? And number four was, how much suffering are you willing to go through for the sake of more time? Since I wrote the article, it's changed my practice. I've started using these questions with patients, and I've been shocked at how transformative they are. I had a patient come in with a colon cancer that had spread throughout her abdomen, and she had gotten through two rounds of chemotherapy that had given her far longer than anybody thought she'd get. She got 7 years with advanced colon cancer. But here was the day she'd come into the emergency room and she couldn't eat anymore. She was throwing up because her tumor had reached the size, had blocked up her bowel, and there was no chemotherapy anymore. There was no radiation. And so they call in the surgeon and say, well, can you try to go in and see if you can hook something to something? And it rarely works. And then you're left with recovering from a major operation, often. Sometimes the tumor grows out of the wound. It becomes a mess. It becomes very difficult. And so we had this conversation. But I've never been in that position where I could talk them out of going to surgery. We usually end up going. And so we had this discussion. I said, do you know your prognosis? She says, I don't expect I have a lot of time now. But I don't know. Weeks, months, I don't know. I said, what are your biggest fears? She said, she indicated she had two big fears. Fear number one was that she wouldn't be able to go home, that she wouldn't be independent, that she wouldn't be in control of her life. She was a former dancer and of a personal life that she just felt she needed to be in control. And her number two concern was that she'd be a burden on her family and on her daughter in particular. I said, what are your goals? She said, I don't have any particular goals. That if I'm going to get sicker, I don't want to be here. I suppose she said, I suppose I'd want to be with my family. And I said, finally, how much suffering are you willing to go through for the sake of some extra time? None. Had enough suffering. Tired in this last 6 months of being in and out of the hospital. And that helped me then say, I think I have a recommendation for you. If those are your goals, if that's what's important to you, I don't think our going to the operating room is going to be the helpful way to go. We can do some things to make it so that you're not sick and throwing up. We can do some things to make sure you're not in pain. And she chose hospice out of that and was able to be in control, was able to torment her daughter, whose living room she took over. And it was that conversation that we don't have. Family members don't have. Other people don't have.
You have a most surprising, it comes to my mind as you're telling this, most surprising story in letting go of a man who used to be a university professor.
Oh, so this was Susan Block's dad. Yeah so here was the palliative care specialist.
Extraordinary. I mean, I was so surprised. I mean, tell it. I was so surprised by what he felt was a goal, because he did have a goal.
Yeah. So this was the palliative care physician who had spoken to, speaks to 100 people a year facing these questions. And her own father developed a tumor in his spinal cord, which was going to require this extensive operation with a major chance that it could leave him quadriplegic. She was his healthcare proxy, his decision maker if he couldn't make the decisions. It was the night before surgery, and she went out to California, spent time with him. He was a psychology professor. And they and just chatted about this or that, and family came and went, and she just felt she'd really had some great quality time. And then she got in the car and drove across the Bay Bridge to her family home for the night, and halfway across the Bay Bridge realized she didn't have the conversation. She didn't know what he would want. So she turned the car around, said, of all people, I got to have this conversation, and went back and asked those questions. And the most telling one was if he should get sicker, if bad things should happen, what would he want to live for? What's really important to him? And he said, as long as I can watch football on television and eat chocolate ice cream, that'd be enough to live for. And it floored her. Because he's this emeritus psychology professor, and he'd never seen, she'd never seen him watch football ever. No idea, late in life he was a football fan suddenly. And chocolate ice cream. But then he went through the surgery, seemed to go well, but then developed bleeding afterwards. And they were going to need to take him back. And he was still groggy and anesthetized, and they came to her and said, we're going to need to take him back, but the bleeding has already caused him to become partially paralyzed. And he may well come out of this quadriplegic, but we could save him, at least keep him alive. What do you want to do?
And she knew.
And she said, he'd already decided for me. She asked him, will he be able to watch football on television and eat chocolate ice cream? He said they thought he probably would be able to. Okay, then go ahead. And he did. He was quadriplegic, not totally paralyzed. He had just enough hand function to, over the next 7 years, write 2 books and a dozen articles. It was actually when he, at about 7 years, lost the ability to eat chocolate ice cream. His swallowing problems became bad enough that everything he ate went down the wrong way, and he had a series of pneumonias that he said no more. And that set of questions, those puzzles, what would you want? What is enough for you to want to live for? And does your family and do your clinicians know that that's what you want? We don't do that.
I was going to read to you a scene from a very favorite book of mine, The Death of Ivan Illich of Tolstoy, which describes a doctor. And so I want the doctor to comment on the writer describing the doctor. At 11:30, the famous doctor arrived. Again, there were osculations and significant conversations in his presence and in the next room about the kidney, about the appendix, and questions and answers with such a significant ear that again, instead of the real question of life and death, which now alone confronted him, there reemerged the question of the kidney and the appendix, which were not behaving as they should, and for which Mikhail Danilovich and the famous doctor were about to fall upon them and make them mend their ways. The famous doctor took his leave with a serious but not hopeless air. And to the timid question which Ivan Illich addressed to him, raising his eyes, glittering with fear and hope, whether there was a possibility of recovery, he replied that, though he could not vouch for it, there was such a possibility. The hopeful look with which Ivan Illich saw the doctor off was so pitiful that on seeing it, Praskovya Fridorovna, his wife, even burst into tears as she came out of the study to hand the famous doctor his honorarium. So this is seen ring true to you.
Well, and it's an amazing short story or novella. I guess it's a short story or novella, but somewhere in between. Because and it's taught to many students. I read it as a medical student as well, in hope that we are able to get that sense of the aloneness of the person who is with a fatal illness, the struggles they go through to acknowledge and not acknowledge, and cycle the psychological acuteness of Dostoevsky in recognizing what the experience of dying is like, and the thing that came across to me the most and stuck with me the most is the sense of aloneness that the person felt, that no one was able to connect with him. They were always connecting with parts instead of the person. There was the way his wife was focused on not him and understanding him, but instead their usual issues, the way the doctor was with the kidney and the appendix. And it is strikingly familiar, isn't it? And that's the sense in which I said, I don't want to romanticize the past or to idealize the past. It's just that the nature of illness changed the time course of what happened, and that led to certain rituals and ways we dealt with things. That still offered some control in a way that we have taken away. And if we want to reclaim life, we have to reclaim death. And if we want to not be alone, we have the possibility. We have great experience and wisdom that has developed over time that mean that people don't have to be Ivan Illich in that last phase. But we in medicine have not made it any easier.
Do you sympathize at all with the doctor in this story?
Yes, it's me. there are many, many moments when, I'm not a writer when I'm at work. When I'm at work, I'm, in a 20-minute visit where I've got 18 people stacked up and I've got to get through from one thing to the next. And
so you don't have the time for the conversation.
You think you don't. You think you don't. Mm. And it does take time. As I've become, in many ways, writing is my way of thinking out loud and working through problems. And having worked through this and then begun talking to patients in a different way, first of all, some of the most meaningful conversations and experiences in medicine have come out of my experiences since then, which is surprising to me because most of what you enjoy and become satisfied in medicine about are your competence. Your ways in which you're able to fix something. And here is something unfixable. But you start feeling competent about how you can help someone who has an unfixable problem, that you can help them and arrive at what the goals might be in the face of that. And then, yes, what often takes the longest time is the family. The patients are the readiest to have that conversation and work their way through it.
And the family,
they haven't gotten there. Yeah, they're not.
And you mentioned this in the article as well. It's a, that so many of the operations happen because the family says there must be something else that can be done. There must be something else that you can do for my father, my mother, my sister, my brother, somebody close to me.
Yes, in a family meeting, in a room of three or four people, the dynamic that often occurs is that there is a person who will say, "You're not going to unplug. You're not unplugging Ma, are you?" And all the gravity in the room then moves to that person. The sense that there's no response to be had to that. Or surely there's something that we can do. People in a family don't want to fight against that. And also, these moments bring out the worst in families. I mean, these are among the most stressful experiences, and all families have their issues, and so it brings out those issues. And one of the striking things that also have come out from the surveys of patients is that around 2/3 to 3/4 would rather take a treatment they do not want if their family wants it than make their family go through the experience of not.
So they don't want to cause pain.
They don't want to cause their family pain, and they'd rather suffer themselves.
And yet doctors at times cause pain, and the whole oath you sign to become a doctor is thou shall not cause pain to others.
Well, no. As a surgeon, I'm not signing that oath. But
yeah, okay.
But the do no harm concept.
Right.
And even then, you're doing harm for the sake of a bet that in the long run it'll be good for you. And in with a patient with terminal illness, that's a much more complicated concept and idea. But yes, you are causing pain for family. It's an interesting problem. You may be able to, you know, I tell the story there as well of a young man with a brain tumor who fails finally. Don't want to say fail, bad word.
Yeah.
Whose disease progresses despite three rounds of different kinds of treatment. And the question to the oncologist was, surely there must be something more. And there is this concept that the Swedish talk about of a breakpoint discussion, which is a very formalized way that they try to have a discussion at a moment when you might want to discuss whether this is a breakpoint, a moment when we might get off the treadmill of the next treatment. And that discussion they went through with this patient of saying, yes, well, there may be these other kinds of treatments, but in her experience, it makes matters worse rather than better. And he came to terms with that. And then when they had the family meeting, the wife, the mother came to terms with it, but the father was silent throughout. And then at home made it very clear this oncologist is missing something. There are things out there. Did an internet search, has a sheaf of trials that could be done, things that could be brought. And the oncologist really found that her patient was the father, and went so far as to go home to talk with a father and go through every one of those sheets to see which one of these might work, called a couple of the trial people to see, is this genuinely a patient who could apply for your trial? And then, you know, walked one by one through all of them to say, these are not likely hopeful. And then asked the father to help her son, his son. But the most important thing he needed from the father was his strength for him as he faces what is coming. And they had a transformed month because of the time and the investment to get
there. So here we're coming back to what we were missing at the beginning. Here we're coming back to the possibility of actually having a meaningful conversation, of spending those last moments together, really together, instead of spending those last moments with machines.
The really interesting thing about this, and Dostoevsky was getting at this as well, is that one of the most powerful tool in all of this is mere conversation. And it's almost we almost don't believe it. We don't believe it. We don't believe it in medicine.
I promise you I believe in it.
We don't believe it in medicine. We don't believe it in policy. We fear it. We fear it to the point that we, in the healthcare debate, the concept of giving doctors sufficient payment to have extra time for primary care doctors to have these conversations was called death panels and nearly doomed all of healthcare until they stripped out the provisions and guaranteed your doctor would not be paid to have extra time to have these conversations with you. Very important. And the concept that this is so powerful, the studies that I cited indicate the power of just having these conversations before crisis comes because they reorient people and their families towards what they're really aiming for, what they want, how to make better choices. But the experience also is that we're not good at it in medicine. We don't train for it. We're not practiced at it. We haven't actually studied them carefully to understand, you know, what are the forms of conversation that are worse, what are better. It's been very interesting to me experimenting with the words I use with patients. I've had, real failure with some patients who walk out angry and feeling that I've failed them, and others where we've been able to build more effective trust, and I'm still trying to understand it. But there's no question that the skill of conversation is something that we underemphasize in our training. We get very good at the skill of technique of surgery and of our pharmacology and so on, of reading images, and but not reading the patient.
And I'm interested in closing to talk precisely about reading. Hmm. Earlier on today, when we went to the special collections, we were talking about your love of Hemingway. And I know that in your operating room, you have a poem, a Sylvia Plath poem. Why?
The Surgeon at 3 a.m. Not in my operating room, but in my office. In both cases, actually there's an interesting connection between the two, which is that in both cases, most art about doctors, most writing is about doctors as heroes or as villains. And neither are exactly true. Doctors are flawed human beings like the rest of us with bad jokes and a weak chin and things that they know and things that they don't know. And Hemingway captured it in Farewell to Arms. And Sylvia Plath did in The Doctor, in The Surgeon at 3 a.m. And in Farewell to Arms, the main character is injured in the war, spends half the book in an Italian hospital, falls in love with the nurse who's there, impregnates her. She dies in childbirth at the end. Sorry to give that away. But the fascinating thing was his depiction in the little side comments of the vignettes of the people in the hospital. And he had no fear of writing of the doctors simply as people, as they were. Sometimes admirable, sometimes absolutely not. Annoying, flawed people who could do some things that were really, incredible despite the fact that they were pretty ordinary people. And in many ways, among our best medical writers because of it. I admire Hemingway for his concision and brevity and other things as well. And he's very old-fashioned to admire. I'm not supposed to admire him, I think. But he was a moral writer in other ways as well. Sylvia Plath, in her poem, I loved the imagery and the ways in which she used imagery.
Yeah,
and I can't come close to it, but I want things to be as visual when I write. I mean, I love the ideas and I love the story I'm trying to tell and the ideas I'm trying to get across. But also, if it's working, I want you to feel what.
Well, you were saying that the Hemingway Farewell to Arms is the perfect structure for you of a story told.
Well, actually, we were talking about Orwell at that point.
I'm sorry, that's true, that Orwell's essays, you read and reread them because they are the perfect structure of what an essay should be.
They can be. They give me ideas for structure.
To Kill an Elephant, for instance.
Yes. So, To Kill an Elephant was how a story of someone assigned in, I think it was Burma, to as a police officer to deal with a rampaging elephant, and how you use that story to get complicated ideas about what colonialism implies. I don't come close to doing what he managed to do in that essay, so I keep coming back to it to see if I can come closer and closer.
Two items in closing. You quote perhaps somewhat favorably Stephen Jay Gould, a piece he wrote, which is called The Median Isn't the Message. In closing, Stephen Jay Gould says, "It has become, in my view, a bit too trendy to regard the acceptance of death as something tantamount to intrinsic dignity. Of course, I agree with the preacher of Ecclesiastes that there is a time to love and a time to die, and when my skein runs out, I hope to face the end calmly and in my own way. For most situations, however, I prefer the more martial view that death is the ultimate enemy, and I find nothing reproachable in those who rage mightily against the dying of the light. The swords of battle are numerous and none more effective than humor. My death was announced at a meeting of my colleagues in Scotland, and I also experienced the delicious pleasure of reading my obituary, penned by one of my best friends. The so-and-so got suspicious and checked. He, too, is a statistician and didn't expect to find me so far out on the right tail. Still, the incident provided my first good laugh after the diagnosis. Just think, I almost got to repeat Mark Twain's most famous line of all, the reports of my deaths are greatly exaggerated."
Yes, a fantastic essay, and he is one of my heroes. When he was diagnosed with a classically, commonly fatal type of cancer, mesothelioma, he went to the library at the Boston Medical Library and looked up the information, and the median survival was, you know, under a year. It's horrendous. But he's a naturalist. And so what he notices are the variations. And what he saw is there was a long tail of survivors. There were some people who could live very, very long. And he said, that is where my hope is. That is where I can plan for. And he, in fact, lived 19 years after his initial treatment. And I mentioned that I, in the essay, that I don't fail to think of that essay when I have a patient with a terminal illness, that they might be in that long tail. And yet, I totally disagree with that essay.
I know. And why?
And the reason why...
You don't say it quite.
Well,
in the essay, you don't say, "I totally disagree," but one feels you are not in agreement.
No. And the reason why is that, yes, we can hope for that tale, but hope is not a plan. It is not... in other words, the way we have a multi-trillion dollar edifice that has been devoted to buying you a lottery ticket. And yes, that lottery ticket might win. And we want to buy that lottery ticket. Nothing wrong with buying that lottery ticket. Take that first round of chemotherapy, maybe the second round. But what it doesn't mean is that we can't also be prepared for the possibility that that lottery number will not come up after all. I don't see it as mutually exclusive that you rage against the dying of the light, ask for everything that life can give you, grab for that lottery ticket if we can, while also thinking about what are the options, what do I do, what do I want if it doesn't come up.
And is a whole medical establishment based on that long tail?
And on ignoring the likelihood that you might not win the lottery ticket. But, you know, one physician whom I really admire had a great way of putting it, which was that when he talks about the patients about this and tries to find a way to balance this discussion, he says, "Yes, you may beat the odds, and I'm going to do everything I can to help you, so that you and I together will be dancing in the office one day. But I also doesn't mean that we can't talk about what happens if it doesn't?
The dying of the light. Of course, Stephen Jay Gould is mentioning, quoting a poem, a very, very famous poem by Dylan Thomas, "Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light." That poem is very famous, very well known. There is an anger also, an anger of not giving up. Do you remember that poem?
Yes, everybody remembers it for that famous line itself. None of what I described has to preclude that. The martial metaphors of the ways we take on disease are not wrong. But I also think that there are the metaphors that help us understand how we let go. Sometimes it's the idea of the general against forces that are overwhelming. But the concepts of being at peace with our circumstances, being at peace with what life will give us and sometimes take from us, has its own wisdom and its own kind of maturity that we are learning as a society to work our way through. I think in medicine, it is a set of skills for being able to find, you know, it is a natural thing to rage. It is what all of us will do at some point in our life. For us in medicine to feel that, people are the failure here. Why can't they just recognize that you're going to die and just accept it? The reality is someone who's going, that you deal with in medicine, is someone who is in denial at some point along the way and will rage at the situation. And so if we're good at what we do, we're good at dealing with people. And it is not an excuse for us not to be able to offer things that can help people with skill through those situations. The conversation with a patient and their family about their illness is a procedure, no less than the procedure that I do in surgery. I spent years to learn how to do this procedure. And there is no reason we shouldn't be able to be skilled at this other one that's as meaningful and as life-saving in its own way.
Let's listen to the poet.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Though wise men at their end know dark is right, because their words had forked no lightning, they do not go gentle into that good night. Good men the last wave by, crying how bright their frail deeds might have danced in a green bay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Wild men who caught and sang the sun in flight, and learn too late they grieved it on its way. Do not go gentle into that good night. Grave men near death who see with blinding sight, blind eyes could blaze like meteors and be gay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. And you, my father, there on the sad height, curse, bless me now with your fierce tears, I pray. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think Gawande is pleased to take some good questions from you.
Only good ones.
We have mics coming around. If you could just hold a minute for the mic to come. There's a question up here, or a question there first.
When you, if you treat an illness, or like when you go through a surgery, if you prolong a person's life by a year or 5 years or however long, you can quantify that. And it's a lot harder to quantify, well, I made this person happy. What's your opinion on how that makes it more difficult to make that an objective of a surgeon or a doctor? And I guess a follow-up to that is, do you think that a surgeon or somebody who is trained to prolong a life is the best person to have that conversation, or should that be left to perhaps someone like a nurse practitioner, or should someone in hospice, would it be better off to have other people trained to do that kind of work?
So a couple questions embedded in there. One is, how do we measure and know whether we're doing better or not? It's not by, you know, death averted or longer life, and it's been a complex question. One of the ways that people measure is simply by how much suffering people experience. I think the concept of concordance is the one that seems like the idea that would be most important to me, which is that we find that we're able to improve the match between what people want when they when they're arriving at that moment in life, and what they actually experience. How far apart is that gap, and is that gap getting closer and closer together? And so finding ways to measure the concordance of between what people's wishes and goals are and what they actually experience, I think, would be the way to think about it. Now, who is going to be the best at helping understand what your wishes and goals are that you, you know, would consider chocolate ice cream and watching television sufficient for you, or you need to be out in the world with more people for life to be, you know, more important to you? It's going to be different from person to person. And, you know, I would, on the one hand, say, well, yes, in theory, the primary care physician that has known you for many years and gotten to know you and embedded that slowly into the conversations that you've had over time so that they're able to get a good understanding of you is probably far better than the surgeon who you're meeting for the first time in a crisis where you're trying to decide at this moment, what do we do? At the same time, even if that prior conversation had occurred, being able to come back to it, remember, remind ourselves, have that. I think almost all of us have to be better skilled at being able to take care of it. I think that nurses, palliative care specialists, and others who have really focused on these questions do become better skilled than others. And their ability to teach people from that experience. That Mass General Hospital study I told you about where the palliative care doctors achieved 25% longer life and less suffering for the patients, what it meant to me was that there were half a dozen specialists at the Mass General who had become really good at having these conversations for people, and that that great preparation could have really meaningful consequences that were beneficial to people. But can we then send everybody to see that half dozen people? No. Can we create lots and lots of specialists and outsource that conversation to people? That's a possible solution. But the idea that we just further fragment care, the oncologist takes care of the cancer, the chemotherapy, and the surgeon tries to do the cutting, and there's someone else who does the conversation stuff. That just seems to me symptomatic of the decline of the reductionism of medicine and the ways in which we're failing people, and so I think that those are skills where we will turn and find that the nurse is more important in that phase of our life than the necessarily the oncologist, but that they are equipped as a group to be genuinely helpful to you on what you are needing most to meet your most important priorities and concerns,
as you get sicker, as I get sicker, as we all do. I think that's crucial.
Thanks. It kind of ties in with some of this, but my grandson is 21, and he came to visit me this last weekend, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, he said to me in the morning, Saturday morning, he said, Grandma, he said, we're going to be going soon to Afghanistan. And he said, you know, a lot of people are talking about a lot of the boys coming back, you know, with brain injuries and stuff. And he said, what I want to know is if that happens to me, because he wants to come back and write. And, he likes Hemingway a lot. And he said to me, he said, well, so if I come back and I have a brain injury or something, will you take care of me? And I said, of course. I work at the Department of Health, and we use your bell curve essay, as a matter of fact. But I know it's a hard question, but I've been thinking about what else I might say. I felt reluctant to talk about it in a way just yet, you know, with that he said that to me with his mom and dad. His mother's my daughter. But what kind of conversation might I want to have about this? I mean, this is a tough issue for a lot of people. Thanks.
What an amazing grandson. First of all, to want to go and has not overly romanticized the idea of what going into battle and that environment would be. Second, to be thoughtful about the worst case of what could happen. Clearly, it's worried him. And that's probably the most interesting thing and maybe important thing about it is what are, you know, I think of that question I raised earlier, what are his fears? And that might tell you more than anything. What is it that are his fears and concerns about going and about what might happen to him? That might be revealing as well about what he's really going for and what his priorities are.
I would suggest he read your piece too.
Yeah.
Is this just talking to it? First of all, I completely believe in hospice care. My husband spent the last three months of his life at home in hospice supported care, and they were incredible. They came in twice a week and helped in whatever way they could. But one thing that they didn't address that's not part of the hospice system that they were unwilling to address is when a patient who has no hope of bettering their situation, who are on a downward spiral of quality of life, is accelerating the end of life. And I wondered what your opinion was on addressing that.
Euthanasia.
Exactly, in a candid way. It was actually something that they would not even discuss. And I wonder what your opinion was on that.
I understand it. I come from a background that makes me highly suspicious, and that background is that my work's been in patient safety and improving the quality of care, and what strikes me over and over again is how often we get decisions wrong. We have 40% of coronary artery disease patients who receive incomplete or inappropriate care, 60% of stroke patients, pneumonia patients, asthma patients get incomplete or inappropriate care. And making mistakes about who should be offed, who should be put to sleep or not, is a huge fear for me. We already make mistakes that cost hundreds of thousands of lives. And the danger in my mind is that if we can't get those basic things right on that end, what will we get wrong on this side? There are patients who are suicidal or want to die because we have not been able to treat that. We have not treated their pain properly, or because they're depressed and in need of treatment for depression. One of Jack Kevorkian's patients, whom he put to death for a breast cancer, turned out to have been successfully cured on autopsy. Our trust in the health system is based around the idea that we are there to help people and that we believe that these people whom we've given awesome powers to I'm allowed to put people to sleep and cut them open with a knife and you trust that I'm not there to do harm. I worry about losing that trust. I don't rule out the concept categorically. But the most critical thing to me is that we think hard about mistakes. My opposition to the death penalty is heavily around the question of whether we make mistakes. This is not a... Say it again. Sometimes it is unequivocal. And toward the end, the suffering can be great. There is the double effect of treating someone's pain and that sometimes hastening death towards the end. And I don't hesitate with my patients who are in pain to give sufficient pain medication for them to be able to be free of pain, even if that means that they may not be able to breathe or anything after that. But the concept of because of the pain that might come or the situation that might come, that I would extinguish their life, that troubles me, mainly because of the fallibility that I feel is inherent in all of us. But it's a struggle because there are people who genuinely suffer and they are coming to the end, and it's not just pain that they're suffering. It's simply something that they don't want to go through. I talked to a patient recently who is going through a cancer that is advancing, and he said, I don't want to go through this. They're getting sicker day by day. You know what's happening. Yes, I can do. We can do this for pain and that for depression and so on, but he simply does not want to. That anxiety you described earlier, it's unbearable, and they just want to not have to bear it. And I understand that, but I fear the error.
Just wait 1 second for if I don't know how many mics there are.
This may be a little bit of a stretch from this conversation. I'm almost 8 months pregnant myself, and it's my second child. And I chose a home birth for my first child, and I'm choosing the same. I'm making the same decision for this child, but with a lot of fear. I was thinking during the course of your article and also listening to you tonight that we've done the same thing with birth. We've medicalized it, and for very good reason. I mean, birth was very often the end of a woman's life and the end of a child's life, and we've managed to really change those statistics. At the same time, it's taken away something also very important, maybe the same something at the same level of kind of taking away those meaningful moments or conversation by medicalizing it. And we've maybe over-medicalized it where, you know, the statistics are looking pretty bad in terms of the amount of surgery, maybe unnecessary 30, surgery.
30% C-section.
Right, in some hospitals, up to 50%. Sorry. So the question is, but there is also this fact that like when something wrong happens, and you never know when that's going to happen. It doesn't only happen to other people. That it's better to be in a hospital. The same way that you mentioned that when that you never know. Like, is hospice right, or would you be missing that one thing that you could do that could still? Like, I would see how people would want to keep pushing. The same way I'm hesitating. And saying, well, should I not just be the safest as possible? Like, yeah. It feels like there's always that trade-off.
Question.
Well, so you're asking about what is the, yeah, so how do we understand this trade-off? Well, I mean, on the one hand, I do work, so I'm in charge now for the World Health Organization of a program for safer childbirth as well as safer surgery. And in the low-income parts of the world where 99% of our avoidable deaths in childbirth occur and the death rates for mothers and newborns are just horrendous. I mean, some of the places that we work in, it's just criminal how many mothers and newborns die. The major push is get them out of the home into facility delivery and make sure the facility is safe enough with basic infection measures and basic availability of blood transfusion and other capabilities for being able to reverse a problem that's been reversed here. It's no longer the number one killer of mothers, of women under 45 and of children. But we've also advanced to the point that we have developed systems around being able to be at home safely, that we can make a distinction between people who really are at risk for being at home safely for birth and those who can be in the hospital, that we can provide sterile conditions and infection control and dealing with bleeding, availability of an ambulance that can get you to the hospital. There are anecdotes and stories of, you know, people who where bad decisions were made at home and a child lost on the way. And yet our general national statistics are that home birth in a low-risk mother appears to be just as safe as delivering in the hospital and valued very much by the people who have that experience. And so I think with the right supervision and right decisions, it has become, it's an interesting cycle. We've been able to take it out of, we are saving lives in other parts of the world by bringing people into facilities. And in our setting, we want to, you know, remove that 31% C-section rate on average in the United States and begin to transform it while still making it what it is today, where it is so rare, it's literally a few hundred women out of millions of births a year who would ever die.
Let's take one great last question.
I have a comment and a question. You were talking about the importance of conversation, and a lot of the comments from the audience were about conversations. I noticed that a lot of what you were talking about was the conversation at the end of life, and I just recently finished my dissertation, and I was looking at the fact that people might be learning about death and their idea of the afterlife from what from the media, specifically what they watch on television. And I did look at web discussions surrounding some of these television shows that deal with topics about death and the afterlife, and found that people, even those self-identifying as professionals, as doctors, attorneys, engineers, you know, well-educated people, as well as religious people, were having serious conversations in these web discussions about what they thought would happen after death, what happened to their loved ones after death. And a shameless plug, I found that I thought it would be important to have a website, wetalkaboutdeath.com, which I'm working on creating, because people seem to want even a safe haven in these web discussions so that they could be having a discussion without rejection or being mocked. And I wanted to ask you about your point of view about these discussions in the media, what the media is doing. I noticed the New Yorker magazine seems to have an article about death or somebody's experience with death quite frequently lately. And I recently heard that the BBC is planning to air a show about an 84-year-old man going through a death experience, and there was discussion about whether that was in poor taste. So I want to ask if you think the media is the place where the conversation should begin, and obviously your article may have been part of that.
Well, thank you for the question. I mean, the media is a mirror in many ways of our obsessions and the ways we begin to look at things. I'm not convinced it gets a lot farther ahead of where people are. But we're seeing a change in the conversation that occurs. Partly there's a lot of misinformation. I'm not even sure we in medicine are as clear about the statistics. So, for example, there was a study looking at what the survival from patients getting CPR is on the television show ER while it aired. And it was something like 60% survival rate or 70% survival rate, which is nowhere near what the reality is, which is less than 5% for everybody on the whole. And then for people with terminal illness, a minuscule, vastly less than 1% who have any chance of being revived even temporarily, and none having, you know, long-term survival from it. And so media can be a source of misinformation, and that has to be addressed. But then the other thing is that it's a place where we're starting to have, you see the effects of conversation. I don't know how many of you ever watched the show Breaking Bad, but the lead character knowing he's going to die and the process by which he's doing it being the theme and plot of what's going on. And the conversations are the most fascinating part and the most dramatic and cool part of the television show. And so seeing how art and sometimes well done, sometimes not so well done, experiences play out in the media is a fascinating window on what we're all doing. And I feel very lucky that I get to throw my two cents into that along the way.
And we feel very lucky too. Atul Gawande, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.